don't have to go to prison for that. You just look at your wife the next time you're absorbed in something and she wants your attention and she picks a fight. I don't know about you all, but I now have Sunday afternoon drive and Sunday evenings with my family. But in the fall, I have the football syndrome disease like a lot of other people. Well, it's funny how many times my wife will decide to run the vacuum cleaner on Sunday afternoon. Not that the floor is dirty in the family room, but somehow it irritates me. We have a little argument, and I'm no longer focusing on the ball game. I'm focusing on prayer and how much time there is to kiss and make up. But we often fail to realize, and we teach, that a Christian is one who doesn't get angry. If you love God, you can't get angry with God. Somebody forgot to tell Jesus that. Because my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Were the words he said, and he was in his pain and agony. And he said, if we can communicate the ambivalence is part of being real. Back in seminary, I worked for an 82-year-old man, insurance man, who still sells $1 million with insurance a year. And I got engaged. It was actually my last part of college in 13. I got engaged last year at college while I was driving him around. He was crippled. He couldn't drive a car. He was 82, but still with me. I'm driving from place to place. Well, he took on my courtship as his special guidance and advice to consultation. And he told me he and his wife, this is 7 miles, had been married 32 years and never had an argument. Well, my wife and I were fighting every time we got together at that point in our courtship. I was wanting her to, you know, when we took the vows, she'd become one and she'd become me, and she was wanting me to become her. And we fought and fought and fought. And it was probably so sweet and nice that they'd been married 32 years and never had a soft word with each other. Looking back on that now, after almost 17 years of marriage, I realized that they must not have had much of a marriage. And when a husband is hating his wife, or a wife is hating her husband, if they're not ambivalent with each other, something is wrong. So what can we do with that ambivalence? You know what ambivalence is. Sucking your mother-in-law by stealing satellites off the cliff. You're glad to see her go, but what a price to pay. It's having mixed feelings. Mixed feelings to the same object at the same time. And one of the problems is that either internally, they're not able to express it, or externally, we don't allow them to express it. We make them feel guilty, and therefore, that anger they feel for God or life or husband or wife or boss or doctor or you gets internalized into anger against themselves, and they become depressed. Now, if we allow this ventilation, then they can move on within their children. If we don't allow it, then the depression will magnify the guilt and shame that they feel for their lives. And we wind up with a person unable to move beyond in a constructive, healthy, dignified, faithful kind of way. If they're allowed to ventilate it, then they may usually move into the third drama, which I call bargaining versus selling out. The bargaining is what usually happens after they've been able to get their anger out. The selling out is usually what happens if they are only allowed to move into depression. This appears of maybe not me. Maybe I can make a deal. It takes the form of negotiations that all of us are good at. It's somewhat childlike. If I do such and such, then maybe the doctor will do something that it won't do. If I make a deal, maybe God won't. It's kind of a thing that happened, and I've had a good catharsis, and now maybe. Maybe it was all a mistake. Maybe it's not true. I remember in my last church, a man in my church, who had a malignancy and metastasized and dropped by the hospital feeling the pastor and pretty like he came by. I was just thinking of calling you today. See, I've been thinking about things. The doctor says it doesn't look good and I probably won't make it, but I've been thinking the Lord's been good to me. And I really haven't shown how good he's been. I've worked hard, but in success, but he's made it possible. The pastor, you know, if the Lord sees fit to let me get through this, I want to make it up to him. You know, that educational building we've been running and meeting for much for years, and our church is our block off Main and Broadway right in the heart of the downtown area with no playgrounds, youth centers. But if the Lord sees fit, you know, I think that'd make a beautiful memorial. my way of saying thank you, God. But now, James, what do you pray for? You pray for life, to get your education ready, put you to bond. They have to fall into the trap of negotiations rather than recognizing this is another part of the drama of moving toward acceptance. If we can allow him to go negotiate, then perhaps we can help him to move on to reality. Instead of a qualified renewal of hope, it's kind of a way that yet another lady put it so well when she was terminally in a hospital for God. Her son had gotten engaged and they called him wedding off until mother got well. They were in the stage of denial. Mother's not going to die. She said, I knew that I'm not going to make it and I want him to get married. And if I could only live to go to the wedding, then I think I could die in peace. And I said, well, the children kept saying, no, Mama, we'll wait till you get out. Well, we worked it out. We stopped at Moses and so on. So she could take the time. She got all three steps. She went to the wedding. Wheelchair, looking like $1 million. Came back in after the last year wedding. You know what she said? Don't forget, I have another son. Make a deal and put bargain. Now, it's very much like children. We make a deal, we'll say, Mommy, if you let me go outside and play, I promise I won't hit little brother again. Mommy knows darn well that 5 minutes after he's in, sibling rival will take over and he'll call me little brother again. If you let him go. Well, why would he resist on earth? If I can make a deal, if I'm good enough, maybe God will save me. If I'm good enough, maybe the doctors will spend extra time with me. And maybe they'll still want to drive away. If the bargaining period is even enough, if they're not allowed this bargaining period, then what they very often happen is the depression. The guilt and shame convinces them that it's because of their badness, or their unworthiness, or it's the alienation and the depression, inability to relate to others and express their feelings, become so great that they begin to feel a sense of complete hopelessness. And when this happens, the person simply gives up, falls out on living. That's for you. Now, drama 3 moves into drama 4, so the bargaining person is usually moved into realistic hope. So the person who sold out is moved into despair. Bargaining really easily goes thin, you see, when reality sets in. Realistic hope is a period of pre-acceptance, early signs of the final drama of acceptance. Hope becomes realistic. Not the kind of hope of the living that you and I know that it will happen, because they're aware now that it is going to happen, but a kind of realistic hope that says, I hope such and such about it. For example, the woman who develops feels a lump in her breast, and before she's in the breast, she hopes it's just a lump and not a cancer or tumor. And then when she gets to the doctor, she hopes that if it is a tumor, that it's benign and not malignant. Then she hopes if it's malignant to say it's early and they can get it out. And if they can't get it out, she hopes that they will be able to do as much as possible so they won't be too painful, too prolonged, too expensive on her husband. Or if it's going to be long, she hopes that her children are strong enough to make it and she's taught them enough and give them enough love that they can see it through. Or if, as one family said, I hope that when my hand gets colder and colder, that I had a warm hand like yours to hold it. A very simple kind of realistic hope, based upon the reality and the progress of the world. For those of us who are living, hope tends to be the sometimes as well, but as not. And what we often miss is the need of the dying person to be able to latch on to a very simple kind of hope, that they won't be alone, that others will be with them, that it won't be too painful, that the family can get by. Not that I'll get well, but that it will happen. It will have certain needs. The alternative to this is simply to enter the valley of despair. The shadow is no longer there. It's the total darkness of night. It's hopeless. There's no possibility of meaning. It's total void. And it's the pre-resignation period. It may take on the characteristics of depression, and this is why I think that Dr. Ross calls it stage depression, but I see it as more intense than that, because I see it as a totality involving theological as well as psychological significance. It may sometimes be expressed as stage bitterness, but in every situation, the person has filed spiritual bankruptcy. Just to you, there's nothing more. Now, the final drama that patients tend to go through if they're allowed to be accepted, and if they're not allowed to move constructively through to wind up with designation, yes, it is me, can be said many ways. It can be said in affirmation, yes, it is me. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Or it can be said with resignation, yes, it's me. With a kind of bitterness and despair of my meaning. Fulfillment of this process in which the person has been able to move through the valley of the shadow to a point of being able to affirm death as the fulfillment of life. It implies a basic trust in the goodness and value of life, a sense of meaning and purpose of what I think Tillich meant when he talked about the courage to be. In contrast, resignation. The logical conclusion to a pilgrimage that spiritually ended in stage two, having sold out and in despair, the patient resigns himself to the inevitable, meaningless end of existence. But I think Kierkegaard was talking about when he talked about the sickness and the death. Our task as we look at it this afternoon will be how can we help the patient move toward the courage to be rather than the sickness and the death of the soul.
Okay, I scheduled it slightly here because I want to give you some sense for response from them. I'd like to ask Norman Neal to come up here and ask you to give about 5-7 minutes of your own individual response, and then if you want to respond to any of their comments for a few minutes, fine, and then we'll open it up for open discussion. Yes, you did, but we'll still let you, I won't need all the time scheduled for the contact after time, so that's fine. I see your actors in space for anyone here who doesn't know them. Dr. Lenny Whipple, who's on the faculty here, just replacement and teaching in a conference program. Chaplain Neil Tate, he's a chaplain with the Mission Association at Putting Hospital in Mountain West. When do you remember your lesson?
Well, I appreciate it very much for the community. Very similar to one of the other Catholics. It's always a question. Because of this one, but they get the question.
Yes. I listened to two items in particular I'd like to mention. First of all, I think we're being led right into an area that most of us probably in our pastoral ministry have confronted, at least for me, a lot of good feelings were stirred. And I think we'd like to look at the setting just a second, thinking of it chiefly since my own ministry was primarily an out of a parish, in terms of preparing our people to meet exactly what Paul is presenting to us. To what extent do we ourselves truly speak of the ending of this life? I think this can be done in a formal way, it can be outlet too, and it can be done in a way that's completely natural. Again, one's own background is bound to come out in this. I had the good fortune of having a father who was very normal about this, I think, more look back upon my own life. And I talking about the passing of relatives or friends was the table conversation for the family. Mm-hmm. The speaker's death was a rather simple thing for us and to confront it. It didn't remove any of the feelings we had as human beings. Like God had a unique way of bringing this out for us, but I shall be everlastingly grateful for it made it possible to move in. Your death was either in the offing or had occurred in one's pastoral care. Now, this is extremely important that the point that is brought out here, because this can see if you're silent around these patients. It's not only a recent experience of a very close pastor friend of mine, Pastor Sort of a pastor's son. So he said in a physician who died, he came back to work on his spine. He sat in the program coffin and instantaneous death. And yet Raymond was one who was prepared, had prepared his own family. And it was interesting to me, Carl, to see how a fellow physician, working with him at the hospital with lead nameless, were reacting to this. Obviously, his own witness to the time when he was dying, he was in both of his research as a pathologist, but he did not hesitate to speak about these things that were happening in the hospital in such a way that when the time came, he insisted on the fact. And this was no mean insistence, Pastor was something that was over the sacrament. But when the family went to carry out his wishes, they had real trouble. He was known as one of the leading physicians in the community. He was beloved by many in the community, and after he was able to be buried in the pauper's box, really carried a hubbub. More disturbance for the wife than to stop in all of the accidental and sudden death. But again, the carryover of this man, the shock of the death was real for his good wife, but what the people around her did was not an exemption to put it into silence, but really the pressure broken on her close area, so he did not afford to turn it to us. So again, I actually understand the setting that we have, it's extremely important. I actually think that the salvation, me personally, is very good. How are we prepared ourselves? It seems that it's anywhere. We certainly know and counsel in the process, but we never are confronting just the one set of needs that someone comes to us. We as a human being have our own, and these two are all intermixed. And we're also in this setting, I think, our own feelings over against the death and dying situation is extremely important. And the goal of the sense, when we speak and not to speak, I appreciate it, by the way, very much. That part of the book here in New York and Spirit. There is a time when we speak, we're taking and how the message we give. I think there's a distinction between when there are members and when there are strangers in countries. It's understandable and we get to work with that accordingly. But I think it's really important that the discussion we had on the silence, the healing effect of silence. But there are times when patients and thought out very well in these sermons here in the text. Where the individual simply probably would not do much speaking. I would assume that he probably could say to the interview that therapy could have brought it out with the techniques that the individual knew he had. But there is a time when probably I should have decided, I think that this stuff I just speaking to you about, to assist with this wife, and not saying much to her at all, probably was more therapeutic for her, hopeful to her, than anything else. I'm imagining such a time this afternoon, but as I say, I don't think this would have been achievable had we not himself. Been prepared for it as a human being, not only by your own upbringing, by the ways of the precious human dear to you, but particularly by the way in which you try to empathize or be able to understand the feelings of the other person that they might be going through. So, setting, I think, is important. I was putting the plea for either hospital now, which is a structured setting, more difficult because you have the either the disciplinary situation, certainly in our parishes where we have much to do. I have the few things father's own family and myself to talk from time to time with the elders in the parish about this, particularly with the fact that we had so many accidental deaths. Some last 10 years in parish since we got a student from here. I don't know whether we were particularly trained there, but we had so many student deaths and we did actually arrive. And it came in not by design really, by one of the student elders in that parish, beginning to raise questions, how do we minister to those people? And he had to feel comfortable. But this led me to realize, especially, to be as much concerned about speaking with this group, healthy people, who are already ministering with the sorrow and the tragedy of people, at a time when we could talk about this and get the feelings out. how he's going to explain how they felt about this and what were they going through. And to share with them, and that's the agent in better understanding of the conflict that they were confronted. But I would again, there's nothing to say, and I'll share that because I think that was a very good job talking about the human rituals that we have today. I would like to emphasize what he did say with regard to anger. I find in dealing with the pastors here, talking to you and speaking out the recent pastors in a minute, that if they are single on this, I feel that I would be the first one to have to say that perhaps my own teaching in the early days stressed and left this area of guilt, left this correction to be desired. We speak of righteous wrath, but I think we're very seldom defined it carefully enough. How it works out in the day-to-day conflict, and certainly the reference to children, I think was out very good. So again, here, I think this is important that we allow this to be able to embrace the kind of a situation coming up. But first, we're going to emphasize what do we do with our own anger. I think there are tremendous number of situations where we hide this anger, and it can really become a gut feeling that needs to get out rather than how dealing with it. And getting the feeling out and dealing with the feeling openly. There's a difference in conversation. You know,
yeah, a lot of questions. Very concise, very well put, I thought. I guess that one of the things that I toyed with as you were talking. In our dealing with our own death, as it relates to our ability to deal with others' death. And I see the comment is in contrast, I think, that I think theologically we have moved down the road a little bit from where I started anyhow in Sunday school, that we theologically, I think, try to deal with eschatology a bit more realistic, in terms of recognizing that there is death, as opposed to a kind of denying of the fact that people die. I think that, at least as I see theology today, there's a point which we are recognizing death as a termination. And I don't know if one wants to open up that whole bag of theological material, eschatology. But I see it as very important in how people move towards death, as whether they recognize or have recognized as they have been taught. I think this is kind of what many are saying in a sense. When you're dealing with people, they recognize that death is imminent and that they are going to die, or do they recognize it as a kind of a long sleep and we're going to wake up and things come to be real nice and pretty and so you don't worry about it. And then when it comes upon you and society denies death kind of culture we live in, then it really throws one into a panic because he hasn't learned theologically how to deal with it particularly. The instance in the hospital reminded me of a story supposedly true, but I don't know. It didn't happen at our hospital because we don't have those little speeches in the wall that speak to people. If anyone gets talked to, somebody has to be in the room to talk to them. So I guess that's one advantage of a municipal institution that can afford some of these luxuries about the fellow from the country. Put a kid, you know, just put on pediatrics. And he was laying there, scared to death in the dark. And the nurse was listening on the monitor. And she couldn't even hear him breathing. So she said over the monitor, "Johnny," and she didn't hear anything. And she said, "Johnny," and still didn't hear anything. Finally, she said, "Johnny, answer me." And she said, "What do you want, Laura?" I was wondering by way of question whether you find doctors and residents more honest than physicians could have been otherwise. I don't know that you done anything about this in particular. I've been, I think, kind of impressed with the city hospital that our doctors tend to be pretty honest with people in terms of things. I don't know how universal that is. I haven't done any research. I notice it primarily in terms of the patients that respond by saying the doctor told me. And how many of the doctors didn't tell, I don't know. But I've been rather impressed, at least in our institution, that doctors are willing to go. Yeah, you have leukemia. You have a malignancy that we can only see the radiology is passed. We can only delay it. And we'll try and ease the pain and some of that stuff. And for those people that they told that it's been a good response on the part of the people, they are usually mothers who are heads of households, who have children who have things to take care of. And they have been most grateful and thankful to the doctors because it has given them time to make arrangements. One leukemia patient that I think of particularly was divorced and wanted to make legal arrangements to see that the father, you know, would not be eligible to take the children because he would not be a good father for the children. And he was able, by knowing about this, to take the kinds of precautions that would assure his children of having a good family life even after he died. And then I thought, or think, that maybe in terms of our working with grief, whether it's the dying person or the family of the dying person, and maybe you want to comment on that, certainly with some people anyhow, it's more than just allowing them the opportunity to vent anger, to bargain, to feel that it encourages, it's kind of feeding this, in as much as they can take it anyhow, to be in a relationship with the people where you are kind of encouraging these expressions of feeling gut reactions as opposed to just kind of sitting passive there. You didn't say this, but this is how it comes down. It's kind of sitting in just allowing it to happen when it might happen. We can probably be very effective in encourage them to go to the more healthy side of dealing with their dying than kind of sitting by and watching them fall into some of the unhealthy aspects of dying. Again, thank you.
Let me see if I can take a couple minutes to let. Well, I appreciate both of you. You're much too nice and tender with me. My students aren't really that nice to come back in Chicago. I would agree with most of what you said, although you didn't tell us how you handled it with your children. You told us how your father handled it with you. I'd be interested if you find it possible to talk with your children the way your father talks with you. I find it still a problem with me, and my but I didn't have the time you had to talk about it. How you do it. I'm concerned about the type of silence, though. I don't want to just condemn silence for sure. I think that the kind of silence you're talking about is communion kind of silence. There's something that's going on between you and your parishioners. And silence isn't a way of avoiding something. I think you would agree with that. But when we share the value of silence, we sure we underline a kind of silence that's really in rapport with each other. And it's not a silence that you're imposing upon the relationship, but rather it's emerging out of the relationship. And that's how it's happened between the two of you that's sitting beside the bed. Not saying anything is a way of saying something. I'm with you, you're not in the valley of the shadow alone, as opposed to silence because I don't know what the heck to say. And I was told that I couldn't pray every time I get uncomfortable. And so is my vision of prayer. I think you'd agree with that, to underline the quality of that.
You speak.
I think the best built-in liability of clergy is that the more anxious to get, the more respect. Like the pastor who left his notes in the pulpit when the bankers found him, and the margin said, "We should yell like hell." that when you don't know anything else to do, and I took on prayer as one example. Going over to Balaam with my students, when they feel ready to leave, they give a benediction in form of the prayer. And it's sometimes a substitute for relationship, rather than an actual symbolic way of bringing together this relationship into a vertical dimension of communion. I'm glad you raised it. I just want to underline it and say that we're talking about quality here at this point, relationship. With respect to your comments, and I'm sure the group will want to respond to both of them. I only deal some with eschatology this afternoon when I deal with life perspective. I think all of our patients just about are told by hospitals in the attending men are our teachers. We don't have any private patients in our teaching institutions. So in our situation, you see half of our patients have not been told, which shows that half of the time our staff are not comfortable. It is true that theology students, nursing students, social work students, and medical students all seem to be far more open than ministers, social workers, nurses, and doctors. They say, well, we have 39 registered for the Death and Dying seminar this course. We're coming every week and writing papers on it. And I suggest that about 10 of them will write papers in a very suggestive way about what death means to them. And we have seen some very startling responses from students. I think that's sort of self-explanatory. Whatever, whenever we get the degree and out, we sort of come out with language. We don't have to learn anymore. We become rigid rather early. Now, I'm not so sure I go along with you, though I think the point is right about perhaps it's more than just allowing them to ventilate. We can encourage it. But I've gotten my fingers burnt on that, to where I don't encourage people, professionals, to push the patient. We have to learn the difference between responsive listening, where we encourage them, and presence. And what I found is, far too often, is we're so anxious to see something happen that we call, we push, and we break down the fences. And in our seminar, we do stress listening and letting the patient go his pace. Friday in the autumn, where half the people were angry with us because we didn't push the patient. To push that patient would have been to tear down the fence. And he knew it was right now. I don't take that question. I like the word responsive listening, meaning that we not only listen, but we respond to it in an encouraging way. And I particularly like the word enablement. We enable them to breathe. And enabling implies a more active and just a passive way of listening. But it doesn't mean that you are disrespectful of the defensive and you go in hammering and breaking through. They can get jealous sometimes. We read a book and get jealous and you want to go out and be and you read a book and jealous. That I would want to do.
We'll take about 10 minutes now for questions, open discussion in the group, and then I'll have about 10 minutes with you on the contact pass plan before we meet. So I'll try to moderate you and see what we're doing. Okay.
Most of our patients are pretty well. The youngest we've had is 17. Now, Dr. Ross, for the last years, has been over at La Rabita Hospital, which is a living hospital.
hospital, quasi-related to the university, our pediatric staff staffed it, but it's administratively independent. And she's been a consultant over there rather than in the hospital where we are now. And she's working exclusively with children and families this year. But, yeah, children are different. For one thing, the defenses are more primitive. You know, we have to deal with the fact that unconsciously there are no accidents in life. We always have a cause for every effect. And we tend to develop defenses against this in adult life and allow for accidents more. A child is more likely to see, I'm put in the hospital with punishment for being bad, and if I'm dying, there's some reason for it. Where this particularly comes out graphically is not necessarily a dying child, but when a child loses a parent, that child has not wished his mother dead at some point. You know, she didn't give him a peanut butter cookie. Mommy, you're bad. I wish you dead. But that, for a child, death until they're 19, 11 years old, unless they've encountered death personally, tend to see death as going to sleep and waking up. You know, not criminal. Bang, bang, you're dead. Boy, we got a good cop from all these dreams. Now we play again. Bang, bang, the factory, you're supposed to fall down. Well, you get up, you know you're supposed to fall down when the game's over. Then you get back up and then you play again and you're alive again. And death is much more like I go to sleep and I wake up. And so they would find me dead, but they still won't mind to fix your peanut butter sandwich for the lady. That's the cookie time. Now, what happens when you lose someone, you see, and this can become pathological if we don't let it go out. Children, as I say, the defenses are more primitive, more basic, and they're not as refined as ours. They'll come out and see death as the injury or the illness is something that's against them rather than being inside of them. And you see some of this result, because when you talk about children and adults, you know, I think talking about emotional maturity, and it's something that you might have to. I have a sense of a picture that I drew. Children see it coming from the outside against them much more. I'll get in. How do you think it is? But we haven't had enough in terms of seminars in the room to know how they react, to become more efficient with one to one. I find that once we get over our feelings about children dying, that's the hang up. God uses for us to accept the death of an 84-year-old man and an 8-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. Once we realize our feelings, then we're more likely able to help us out here. Five times a week. Let me tell you that Neil and Norman Keon is trying to send me some good things. I was questioning about death and dying, but it sounds really still easy sometimes. I don't know how old things come out. I think that we have a good idea that we have of making the pretty cool about 20 minutes between the months and the first day. At the same time, we practically make some kind of assembly in the hospital for people who really are already there since becoming a family behind this. And I think we make efforts through extraordinary means, you know, for
keep people alive, we really are good at work. There is no other way
to talk
about vegetables. So that's just about that, at least. What are we going to do? You know, how do we touch this thing? Maybe we'll be talking about that later. But here is someone who has a serious brain injury, he's had his car accident, his car accident, and the doctors now have put some kind of an automatic breathing device on the stomach or something like that in here. And so they pull around the circulation of blood and keep the heart going until they arrive. Now the family is just out there. Now what do you do? Because there's only one way out, and that's ultimately to pull this blood and that's it. And you will be coming to death. In other words, when how do you define the death? I guess we're going to do it.
You want to respond to this? Very familiar, and I'll pull the clip. I'm sorry Elizabeth isn't here because she and I disagree on this, and we really had fun at it, meeting up in Rochester. But I'm liberal on this. I think Joe Fletcher, morals and medicine, dyskinesia as opposed to euthanasia is more where I am. Though I think there are some times that perhaps euthanasia by society standards is appropriate. And those are his mother. She gets composed at that point. That's all of her liberal faith. Liberal faith. We both went swimming at 4 o'clock Friday morning, and I never thought I'd do that. And I had crashed here in New Orleans. But at 4 in the morning in New Orleans, I suppose, is not really liberal. We went to bed at 6, and I think he was the only one who went to bed, but it's not of a noise going through. Joe Fletcher talks about prolonging death rather than life. When a person has become a vegetable and is no longer able to communicate at any level with anyone, any kind of life, whether it's through eyes, through touch, none of the things, they have become vegetables, they just exist. And we can keep vegetables alive in 2, 3, 4 years without official means. Now, if that's the kind of thing we're talking about, then pulling the plug is a way of letting nature take its course. They will die without artificial means. If you mean that the vegetable has lost the person, has become a vegetable, and able to communicate, but is functioning without artificial means, then you're talking about killing them by ingesting something or doing something. Well, there are some doctors who advocate that even. And I'm not so sure that what they're not right is when it's irreversible. My feeling is that what we often forget to talk about when we talk about is prolonging life or prolonging death through artificial extraordinary means is that that could be a very valuable time for the family to have the territory duties to where they can come to a point of pushing the doctor. The time is now. Now, Dr. Ross feels that the patient who genuinely both consciously and unconsciously wants to die, will die. I'm not so sure of it.
Well, I think it's time that the other part of the family, and this is the lieutenant's mind experience, is that the family is happy. When I was taking the family and say, look, don't you think it would be best to say that? I think that our family don't separate it.
Really, just their anger.
Well,
usually they begin to get angry with the person. Going on and on and putting them through all this. That's not all of them.
And there are feelings of guilt, and this may be religious. There are feelings of guilt if they really, they just don't think it's awesome to wish this person dead.
That's what I mean. Wishing them dead is the expression of